Accession number 20937, Reel 6.
Neville Howell, Reel 6.
Those activities to follow were what would be known later as an invasion, and we would be playing our part in that invasion. It was now decided that half my regiment, that is two batteries out of the four in my regiment, would re-equip with American tank destroyers. A whole new ball game for those of us who had only played around with the ground guns before. And it was decided to post the younger sergeants to the batteries that were re-equipping with tank destroyers. And I was one of those who was posted to another battery, namely 234 battery. The other battery in the regiment, which was re-equipping with the tank destroyers, was number 198. In 234 battery, when I joined them, they had no equipment whatsoever. Remember, we were all in civilian billets scattered around Felixstowe. And so it was a case of waiting around until this new equipment arrived. Eventually it did. I think possibly it may have been about February, March time before we saw these tank destroyers. And we had to find out as much about them as we could. I don't recall there were any instructors come along, people who knew about them, so we had to work from books and do our best to discover what it was about them that was going to be different for us. They were, if I can give a brief description of the tank destroyer, they had previously been an American tank. It was found that by removing the old tank turret and replacing it with another turret which had no top to it, it would serve as a good gun platform for anti-tank work. It weighed approximately 30 tons and looked similar, very similar for people who are familiar with the Sherman tank, looked similar in some ways in that the suspension was exactly the same. Anyway, these tank destroyers were equipped with the American 3-inch gun. That was the main armament. Secondary armament was a 50 caliber Browning machine gun mounted on the rear of the turret. And we learned how to strip the machine gun. It's a fairly heavy machine gun, 50 caliber, and we found out more about the gun. We found out as much as we could about the method of driving the things. It was by two tillers, the same as most tanks, and how to change the tracks on them. And the sergeants attended once on a shooting range to see the things being used. I didn't get to use one myself. It was a case of back to the unit again and sorting out gun crews. I had one person in that battery, that is 234 battery, who had been with them in the desert, but I didn't even know. I didn't see much of that battery in the desert, but here I now saw him again. I'd previously seen him, he was a Lance Sergeant, I'd previously seen him in the old 36 Signal Training Regiment. That was the last I saw of him when that disbanded. Now he volunteered to come as my number two. He was a Lance Sergeant Ron Barlow from the Manchester area. And so we had a crew. I had two other people in the crew, my gun layer and another crew member who had been through the desert. That is my driver, my wireless operator. There were two wireless sets in these tank destroyers. My wireless operator was a young lad who hadn't been in the army very long, but had been trained as a signaller and knew how to operate the wireless. Time came for us to go down to another part of England, into camps, ready to take part in whatever was lying ahead for us. Only the two batteries that were equipped with tank destroyers were engaged in at this time. The other two batteries with ground guns, that was my old battery and another one, were remaining behind for the time being. Went down to a place not far from Winchester, where, like lots of other people in the area, we were confined to an area, a field, under canvas. Strict orders, nobody allowed to leave without permission, not even allowed to go out, whatever. And we did one dummy run to the dockside, somewhere near in Southampton, I don't know exactly where. And then it was a case of waiting around for the time to come to embark for the real show. We had never done any manoeuvres with these tank destroyers, so we'd had no practice whatsoever regarding camouflaging them and that type of thing. What we did do, whilst we were waiting to get called to embark, was to carry out waterproofing. Waterproofing using different types of material so that we could, if it became necessary, take them through water to a depth where, in fact, the driver and the signaller would be underwater with just the top of the turret clear. And the time came eventually for us to make our way to the docks for the real thing. I remember it was a Saturday evening when we started off. It was extremely cold, and I believe a little light drizzle. It got dark rather quickly. It was a very slow journey because the road was obviously cluttered up with convoys, other regiments, other people who were moving down to the docks. And I remember on one occasion we stopped outside some little houses and bungalows on the side of the road, and I was rather surprised that nobody came out to look at us or whatever. They were obviously still occupied, but I suppose the people in the area were so used to seeing people making dummy runs to the docks and that type of thing. So anyway, we went down to the docks in Southampton, and sometime in the early hours of Sunday morning, we embarked on tank landing craft. There was a mixture on the craft. There were only two of my troop, myself and another one, on my landing craft, together with some vehicles from other regiments, a couple of tanks, a couple of carriers, and a jeep. That's not much more than that on my landing craft. Later on Sunday morning, my troop commander, Lieutenant Cook, came on board my landing craft and showed me some photographs of where we were expecting to land. He issued me with maps of the area, and we'd be dished out with some money, for French money. I think it was special army money anyway, but yes. And later, I think it was much later that day, when we sailed out and anchored off the Isle of Wight, and there were vessels of all sorts swinging anchor off the Isle of Wight. And then it was the next day before anything happened. Around tea time, together with all the other stuff that was, all the other vessels that were there, we set sail. And I remember it was rather cold, nice storm. Very low clouds over the top all the time, so it got dark rather quickly. I'm not quite sure. I think there was a little light drizzle again and rough. But I normally used to feel seasick very quickly. I'd even been seasick on the Thames on one occasion when I was on an ammunition barge. But on this occasion, I didn't feel seasick. Don't know why, but no, I felt okay. We spent that night sailing on deck. Obviously, the accommodation on board these landing craft was very limited, and we weren't invited to go take cover, take shelter anywhere. And so we sailed through the night. As it started to get light in the morning, there was obviously to our right, away to our right, probably 3-4 miles to our right, a lot of activity. There was a lot of noise. We could see what we knew were landing craft equipped with rockets, loads of rockets on them. We could see them being discharged. So somebody, if anybody was on the receiving end of them, were having a rough time. But this was to our right. What I later learned was the Omaha Beach, the American attempting to land on Omaha Beach. And I later learned, of course, that they were landing, or supposed to land, before us, because something to do with the tides. It became obvious, as it got light, that we were following. I would like to just explain that we had been told that the destroyers going ahead of us had a job to do. One of their jobs was to drop little buoys in the water with little pennants on them of a different colour, so that people heading for what might be known as King Beach Red would be following a red pennant. It was obvious that we were following the wrong coloured pennants in the morning as it got light, but we still ploughed on. And yes, a convoy of vessels behind us were following us anyway, so they were obviously all following us, and we were wrong anyway. And as it got lighter, and probably we were about, I suppose, half a mile off the beach, off the shore, we could see perhaps a dozen vessels already on or very near the shore, and we were tending to drift to the left as we were trying to go forward, I assume because of the tide going from right to left. And so our skipper had shouted out with a loudspeaker that he would give us a dry landing, and he took us to the left of those few vessels that were already on the shore ahead of us. He took us to the left of those vessels, and yes, we were now heading in. It was quite light. I looked at my watch. It was 23 minutes past 7 in the morning, and the skipper rammed full pelt for the shore, presumably hoping to get well up on the shore so we would have a dry landing. Unfortunately, we could see that we were heading straight for beach defences, and the type we knew, we had been told about them, they were, I think, called hedgehogs. I'm not 100% sure of the name. And these things were on the beach, and we were heading straight, and we ran straight at a couple of these things. I don't know whether we hit one or both of them. And these things had shells on top, pointing in our direction. And there was, as we hit the shore, there was one terrific blast, and I caught some of that because I was sitting up on top of my turret watching this. And this wasn't unexpected at all. Could see what was going to happen, and some of us, I think, gave a little ironic cheer, if you like. The blast blew us back backwards, and unfortunately it blew a hole somewhere, flooding the engine room and damaging our landing ramp, and we started to drift out to sea again. Our drift seawards was arrested by the crew, somehow putting down anchors, I suppose. And So we were stuck just too far out to risk going down in the water. One of my crew members had volunteered, because I'd been told that I had to detail one of my crew to go over the side at the front, as on the near the landing ramp was a large roll of like coconut matting. The idea was that this would be unrolled so that if the sand was soft sand, as you left the landing ramp, you ran across this coconut matting without sinking into the soft sand. That was the idea, but that was a rather hefty, huge, hefty roll. If you can imagine a whole roll of carpet, this was similar to a huge roll of carpet, only made of coconut matting, I believe. And anyway, my crew member, because I refused to detail one, Yocky Young, bombardier, he volunteered to be one of those to go over the side to unroll this thing in case we had to try to get ashore in the deeper water. And him, and I don't know who else went, he came back like a drowned rat. The whole roll of whatever it was, coil, coconut matting, had broken free from. They couldn't control it. It was rather a rough sea, and they couldn't control it, and it just floated away. He came back on, and it was, must have been extremely cold water. He was shaking, he was blue. But that was Yocky Young. Spent a bit of time whilst we were too far out, and we couldn't do anything anyway. The skipper calling out over his load hailer, trying to get somebody to come. Other craft were coming in, trying to get them to come and push us a bit nearer the shore. Some smaller assault craft were coming in alongside of us. I believe they should have landed ahead of us, but coming in alongside of us. Some of them were hitting defences, beach defences, and being blown to pieces. And their occupants were floating, some of them unconscious. I helped to pull, with the aid of a boat hook, helped to pull some in close to us and get them on board us. I remember one of them was a Marine Commando captain. One of them we pulled in, he was unconscious. I can remember the skipper calling out, take him below and give him some rum. There was quite a lot of noise going on, of course, but not disturbing to us. We'd seen it all before, bits and pieces flying around. Eventually, another craft, I suppose it would be perhaps 20 minutes after we'd first hit the shore, did nudge us. Another landing craft came, I suppose it was empty, got rid of his stuff, nudged us back inshore and we could disembark. Ahead of me, it shouldn't have happened, but a jeep, a medical officer's jeep, was ahead of me going off down the landing ramp. And the water was just too deep, swamped the thing, and it came to a standstill at the bottom of the ramp as I was starting to go down. And the captain of the jeep tried to stop me, came up there waving his arms and ordering me not to proceed, but I ordered my driver to carry on forward, and we nudged the jeep to one side and we carried on. And we were ashore, and there was no problem. At that time, we were able to go straight in. There was a small grassy plot where we went. By now, a number of other tank destroyers and vehicles from the battery were in the area, and we got rid of our waterproofing bits and pieces so that we weren't hindered by any of that kind of stuff.
Which beach was this?
Gold Beach. Oh, sorry, should have mentioned.
How long had you been out at sea trying to make the landing?
Oh, not long. From the time we first hit the shore to the time we got nudged back in, I don't suppose it was more than about 20 minutes.
And were you under fire all the time?
There was lots of stuff flying about, but not very exciting as far as I was concerned. Like I say, we'd seen it all before. So, yes, we had the advantage. I mean, the poor souls, like my wireless operator, who was now seeing it for the first time. Yes, it was something, but no. No, I know, again, I can still remember, I looked rearwards at one time, and there was what appeared to be a battleship in two pieces. I didn't spend a lot of time looking anywhere, but that was one thing I do remember, looking to the rear at one time and seeing what looked like a battleship in two pieces going down. And most of the noise was way to the right. There were some heavy guns inland somewhere to the right who were firing in our direction. Some of the shells were coming over. Some of them were duds, fortunately. And we got rid of the waterproofing gear, and I think the time would now be perhaps 20 past, half past eight. And we started to... Oh, by the way, I must mention here again, because we had followed the wrong boys, and because we went even further to the left, I believe, in fact, that we landed on what was either the Canadian beach or the very edge of Gold Beach. And we were, I believe, a mile to the left of where we should have landed, which up to a point was fortunate for us, because it was in that direction where a lot of firing was going on. But anyway, yes, we now started to move off to the right, just behind the beach. There was a rising, the ground rose up to the right, and there was like a track going up this rise, and we were moving up this rise about halfway, slowly, about halfway up. We were quite a height then above the shore, and we came to a stop. I dismounted to attend to the wants of nature, and as I went to remount, I'd heard the gun, one of these heavy guns firing to the right. I could hear the shell coming. They sound, these big heavy shells sound more like an express train coming towards you. I took no notice of that, but it landed just as I was about to remount, almost between the tracks at the front of the M10 tank destroyer, showering me with earth, wet earth and sand, and the front of the tank destroyer. This was much to the amusement, if you like, of the rest of my crew, seeing me well and truly splashed with all this stuff. Fortunately, the shell did not explode, otherwise I wouldn't even be talking to you now. It left a steaming hole in the wet earth, in the wet sandy earth, and I was pleased when we moved off from that spot. But the fact that there was a dud was, again, it was a heavy gun, and for some reason, even in North Africa, we'd seen this on a number of occasions, the heavy pieces of artillery, that's the enemy artillery, often their heavy shells had a lot of duds. I don't know why that should have been, but yes, this was something that we'd seen often. We moved on to the right. We then turned inland, where I saw a number of prisoners gathered, had been part of the German forces, but most of them were obviously of some other nation, because they were like Mongolians. I can only explain that they looked like Mongolians to me. And I believe that, in fact, a number of that type of people had elected to go over to the Germans and do their pioneering work or man some of the beach defences and that type of thing. But yes, I saw quite a bunch of those. They'd been obviously recently taken prisoner. And and we carried on a bit further. The small convoy I was in, which was a mixed convoy of us tank destroyers, some... infantry mounted, some tracks, came to a standstill. There was something going on just a few hundred yards up ahead of us, and so we came to a standstill. I was stood outside. There was a bungalow. I came to a standstill, the gate of a bungalow, standing in some grounds, and while standing there, yes, of course, the noise of battle was still carrying on. We were now, I suppose, the best part of half a mile or so inland. We could hear a lot of noise coming from the shore direction. And a couple of, one elderly lady, one middle-aged lady came to the gate. And were talking just for a few minutes. And then said to me, and yes, if you say, could I speak French? The answer is very little. And could they speak English? The answer is no, but it was easy enough to understand what was being said. That there was a German in a shed, which was visible to me. And if he came out, would I shoot him? So I told the two ladies, go and tell him to come out. And no, I won't shoot him. So they went to the shed. And yes, the German came out. He was an elderly man. I told him, motioned him to come to me. He climbed over the gate and came to me, stood near me. And he started to take photographs of his family from his pockets. Meanwhile, he had tears running down his cheek. And I, of course, had no intention whatsoever of doing him any harm. I pointed in the direction of the beach and told him to make his way to the beach. He left and started to walk, and there was a road leading towards the beach, which I told him to take. And he was walking down that road, and just about when he would have been level with a church on the side of the road, a shell from somebody, I know not who, whether it was German or British shell or whatever, took the spire off the church, which came down into the road around the area where he would have been. I've always hoped that he didn't get hurt, and I hope that he made it safely to the beach. Whether he did or not, I shall never know. We then continued inland, and I suppose middle of the afternoon, there was a hold up again. There was quite a lot of fun and games going up just ahead, going on just ahead of us. A lot of noise. Obviously, we'd bumped into some kind of opposition, and we weren't directly involved. Although whatever was going on was only just a few hundred yards ahead of us. Saw some of our people coming back as casualties, infantry, and then some of our boys bringing prisoners back. And we were able to proceed inland, which we did, without any further hold-ups. And by evening, and I would think it would probably be about 7 o'clock in the evening, by then what had been bad weather previously had now turned into quite a nice day. It had been quite a beautiful day. It was decided that we would come to a standstill for the rest of the night and take up defensive positions. I was ordered to take a position on the top of a rise on the right-hand side. This was like a valley. Up ahead were woods, to the left were woods, and there was this one road running straight through the middle and disappearing into the woods up ahead. And I was told to take up a position on a rise to the right. Went up there on the top. There was one dead German lying there on his back. Don't know what had killed him, but he was dead and no sign of injury on him. Didn't interfere with him. We'd learned our lesson a long while ago. Bodies could be booby trapped. We'd learned that from the Middle East. And before it got dark, a German armoured car came from the rear of the column, racing down this one road straight down the centre. All our vehicles were pulled off either side. There was tanks, there was carriers, there were our own armoured cars, all sorts pulled off on either side of this road. And this German armoured car raced straight down and disappeared into the wood up ahead. So he'd remained hidden while we'd gone past him, and then he'd made a run for it as it got dark. And so that was the end of day one, if you like. peaceful end to the day, as far as we were concerned. We didn't come under fire. The only noise I heard that night was when German aircraft were raiding the beaches, I believe. But apart from that, it was a peaceful night. End of day one, can I